Hi, my name is Christina Phillips. I'm a producer for The Exchange at New Hampshire Public Radio. And this is a great program, I think, for people who think they know everything about the state and people who don't know anything about the state. I feel like every week we talk about topics that you may know a lot about, or you might learn something completely new, but every time you're getting to hear from experts, people who care a lot about these issues, people who maybe have not gotten to have their voice on the radio before. It's a great way to learn a lot of things about what makes our state tick and what's important to people around the state. And so if you use this service, if you subscribe to the podcast and you think it's an important part of your life, you should definitely try to support that, whether it's $5, $10, or even $20. Giving is really easy to do. You just go to nhpr.org, or you can follow the link right there in the show notes. And thanks.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Lauren Chulgin, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Well, without a doubt, immigration was the big story this week. And here in New Hampshire, Border Control agents made 5 arrests at a checkpoint on I-93. We'll dig into the controversy and politics surrounding immigration. Plus, we'll hear how Governor Sununu exercised his veto muscles and why Manchester police are getting rid of so-called chief days. It was a busy news week in New Hampshire, and this hour we will break it all down. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477, and we hope you do. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word, NHPR Exchange. Also, we are streaming a live video of this radio show. Very high tech over here we are. So check out the stream at our Facebook page. Again, that's NHPR Exchange. And here to talk all about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Trent Spinner, executive editor of The Union Leader. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hi, Lauren.
Happy Friday.
You too.
Yes,
thank
indeed.
You very much. And obviously, we would love for you, for your listener, to call in. The number again, 1-800-892-6477. So to help us kick off this big immigration conversation this hour, we also have NHPR's Robert Garova in studio. What's up, Robert?
Hey, Lauren.
So you reported this week that there was another Border Patrol checkpoint set up in New Hampshire over Father's Day weekend, I think it was. So what can you tell us about it? What are these checkpoints like?
Yeah, so this is the second one in the last couple months. It's in the White Mountains near Woodstock. Border Patrol agents shut down traffic for a little bit stopped traffic both lanes on the I-93. We know they're arresting folks who don't have legal immigration status. We know that they're using dogs who are trained in both drug sniffing and detecting human smuggling. We also know that they're seizing small amounts of marijuana.
So what are the rules around this? Like if I'm driving up the highway and I come into this checkpoint, I mean, do you have to get out of the car? Do you have to comply? What is it like?
No, I mean, at least initially, you're not asked to get out of the car at all. You're asked about your immigration status. Border Patrol, I'll read you something they sent me. They said, at a Border Patrol checkpoint, an agent may question a vehicle's occupants about their citizenship, place of birth, and request document proof of immigration status, how legal status was obtained, and make a quick observation of what is in plain view in the interior of the vehicle. So no, you're not asked to get out of the car unless there's suspicion.
Okay.
Further.
And so I saw there were 5 arrests made. Where were the people who were arrested? Where did they come from?
So according to Border Patrol, in the last checkpoint, they were from Mexico, El Salvador, China, Ecuador, and Brazil. But, in some of the reporting that I've been doing, I've talked with a family who has been living in the U.S. for decades, were on vacation, up in the White Mountains.
Going hiking or whatever.
Yeah. And, they were arrested in this, too. So it's kind of misleading to say, Mexico, El Salvador. It's like those are the original places people are coming from. But there are other people being caught up in this as well.
Yeah. So is this something, and feel free, Trent and Dean, to jump in here as well. Is this something that Border Patrol has done before in New Hampshire? Do we know, Trent?
They have done this before. Funding was cut during the Obama administration. I've actually been in one of these checkpoints before. And, you know, they try to keep it moving pretty quickly because there are a lot of people. But they have not done these since the Trump administration decided that they wanted to fund this type of enforcement. The ACLU did a Freedom of Information Act request, and they were able to obtain some emails that showed that there will be several more of these coming up later this year. I think there were five more, and they've already done one, so there should be four more coming up later this year.
Yeah,
there
are a number of issues to keep in mind here. Part of it is that the Border Patrol has enhanced capabilities to operate within 100 miles of the border, which is one of the reasons why you're seeing these in northern New Hampshire. You know, there are a number of legal issues swirling around this. The ACLU says it violates the Fourth Amendment for unreasonable search and seizure without probable cause. There have been some issues about the drug seizures and how that relates to the New Hampshire state constitution. The ACLU also says people are not required to answer questions, although the Border Patrol says that they are. So there are just a number of – this has been a real sore point for the ACLU and a number of other groups arguing about kind of the legal parameters of these searches, whether they're constitutional and why the Border Patrol is doing them. Again, this 100-mile zone in which they can operate a bit more freely.
Yeah, and speaking of the ACLU, I somehow completely missed the story until you told me about it, Robert, but agents were seen around a Concord Coach bus line in Bangor, Maine, right? And then the ACLU had a video of this incident. What happened there?
Yeah, so the ACLU, a little over a week ago now, I think, posted a video in which passengers getting ready to board a Concord Coach Line's bus are asked by an immigration official if they're U.S. citizens, and they decline to comment. Then a little bit later, some passengers ask a Concord Coach employee if they have to be U.S. citizens to ride the bus. And he says yes, a couple times, actually. You know, that caused a lot of controversy, calling into question, you know, what is the role of a bus employee? Concord Coach, I actually talked with, the vice president of Concord Coach. His name's Ben Blunt. Here's a little bit of what he had to say about what went on.
While we don't have any partnership or, formal arrangement with CBP, they mostly just show up at our facility unannounced. We disagree with the ACLU's position that we have much of a say about it. And that's based on our legal counsel and the guidance from the American Bus Association.
Again, that was the Concord Coach Vice President Ben Blunt. And this all went down in Bangor, Maine, and yet it's been a big talking point around this immigration.
Well, interestingly enough, you know, it's Concord Coach. We all know they operate. A lot of people take it right out of here at Concord down to Boston. But apparently they actually do a pretty significant portion of their business in Maine, which is one reason why this is happening up there. And again, there's yet another debate about whether or not, as we heard, whether or not a private business has an obligation to cooperate with a Border Patrol. Also, this issue of an employee telling individuals that you have to be an American citizen to ride the bus, which is ridiculous, but was misinformed, and the company has said that they would correct that and have a better information for their employees. But this is just part of a larger constellation of issues that have been fired up since the Trump administration has decided to push harder on immigration. We know it's been a winning issue for President Trump. We've got the midterm election coming up. We have the whole issue going on down in Texas with families and children. Given that we have an election coming up and given Trump's position on these issues, I don't see this really lessening. I think it's going to continue to be a battle with legal organizations like the ACLU trying to push back as much as they can.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So, of course, you're mentioning the big immigration story that dominated the news this week, which was the White House's policy of separating immigrant children from their families at the border. The president obviously signed the executive order meant to end that policy, but there's so much more in question, Trent, about whether that order will stick, how these families will be reunited. So Help us kind of wade through the political ramifications of this first. What was the governor's response and how did that kind of roll out this week?
Well, that was interesting. So a few governors were saying that they were being asked, governors were being asked to send National Guard troops to the border. New Hampshire was not asked, but we asked Governor Sununu and I think other members of the press, there was a lot of interest. Would you do it if you were asked? And he said absolutely not, that they had not been contacted and that they would not. It was a pretty strong quote. He said, "I will not send our New Hampshire troops to the southern border to separate families." So clearly he was trying to distance himself from the Trump administration policy here, which is interesting because Governor Sununu has many times been very supportive of Trump administration policies, but clearly not in this case. So many people were wondering what would the local impact be. And the governor came out pretty quickly to say that he would not be supporting this in any way.
Yeah, Dean, this has been a weird one for Republicans, has it not?
Well, there are real divisions within the Republican Party about how to handle immigration. We've seen Congress, the House of Representatives yesterday, and it's going to continue on now into next week with a couple of competing immigration bills. One was defeated. There's another, quote, moderate version that's still kicking around and may come up for a vote next week. There are issues that you mentioned with the executive order, and there are certain the executive order kind of starts the ball rolling, but there are a lot of implementation issues that need to be dealt with legislation. There's an earlier court order that may complicate Trump's executive order. Some people suggest that he didn't need the executive order. This was simply a policy policy position of the Department of Justice that he could have had the department basically dial back the enforcement. So we haven't seen the last of it yet. I think there are a lot of very complicated issues to unravel. It's all happened very quickly. We did see, as Trent mentioned, the Governor Sununu jump in with the National Guard. There was one or two governors, I think initially it may have been Charlie Baker from Massachusetts.
Was, yeah.
One or two governors initially kind of stuck their necks out. And then it was just sort of an avalanche of other governors saying, yeah, we're not sending our guard. And actually, some have also recalled guards that are already down on the border. So this is a huge issue. It's going to continue to shape, I think, the context of the next election throughout the summer.
And that is interesting. That's the one thing that I wonder about is how much will it shape? Because, you know, illegal immigration is not a huge topic in New Hampshire. We don't see the impact of it that much. But what we saw this week was social media kind of firing up the flames of people who were on both sides of this.
Mm-hmm.
There were people, Republicans, who were saying this policy wasn't strong enough. There were Democrats who were saying that this policy was totally immoral. And I just wonder how that plays out in the midterms. How many people still care about it? How many people vote based on it? And that's something that we'll be watching.
Yeah, it may have an impact on turnout. True, it's not obviously not going to affect New Hampshire in the same way that it would affect Texas or Arizona or New Mexico or southern parts of California. But nonetheless, given the nature of social media and the kind of the connectedness of our electoral politics now, particularly congressional elections in the House are often very nationalized. This is going to have an effect of, firing up both Trump's base. Some people say he's hitting on this issue now because it is sort of a surefire way to have his core supporters turn out in the midterm. And others who view the election as a referendum on Trump believe it'll fire up Democrats. And it may even be sufficient to get some of the divisions between progressives and moderates in the Democratic Party to kind of overlook that and just basically turn out to send a message to Washington.
You know, the other thing that's interesting to me and something that as we've been covering these Border Patrol checkpoints in Woodstock, mm-hmm. When I first went through it, it must have been 8 or 10 years ago, I was like, why are they doing this here in the middle of Woodstock, New Hampshire? Beautiful, like you're surrounded by the White Mountains. What crime could possibly be committed here? Is this really a nexus for illegal immigrants? And what's been interesting to see is actually there is a lot of illegal immigration that's happening right here in New Hampshire. I think the first time around they had several dozen illegal immigrants. This time it was interesting for me to see that they had illegal immigrants from Brazil, China, Ecuador, El Salvador, and Mexico. And that's just to me as a New Hampshire resident is kind of surprising to see that is happening here.
Yeah, the state's more diverse than you may have realized. I mean, what's interesting too is that you mentioned that this is, like you said, Dean, it's happening much more south of us. But yet with these border checkpoints, I wonder if that's stuff that keeps the conversation going in New Hampshire, if people read that in the paper and they say it is happening.
Yeah.
I mean, did we see protests or demonstrations or anything like that in New Hampshire?
I'm trying to recall if there has been some activity. I don't know the extent of it here in New Hampshire.
There's a group that they protest outside the Norris Cotton Federal Building in Manchester, They've been doing this routinely because what's been happening since Trump became president is there's been an increase in the number of deportations happening here locally. And so what happens is, let's say you're an illegal immigrant or you have some other status besides full citizenship, there are times where you have to check in at the federal building and just kind of talk to them about what your plan is, what you're doing. And what we've seen is that sometimes people have been deported because they don't have an appropriate plan or they're here illegally, whatever it is. And so there have been protests, including the Bishop of Manchester taking part in this recently. And they are trying to help these immigrants, illegal or not, in any way possible.
Yeah, there was a great story I saw that Dave Solomon had written in the paper about that. So we'll have to tweet that link out. Briefly, though, on the Democratic side, this week, NHPR's Peter Biello had talked to Congresswoman Andy Custer yesterday. So she has plans to visit the Texas facility where hundreds of children who have been separated from their parents are being kept. And he talked to her about what she's hoping to achieve while she's down there.
To get answers for the American people, you know, another part of this story has to do with the fact that there's no transparency. There have been members of Congress blocked from even seeing these facilities. The press has not been allowed to inside to see these facilities or to film them to show the American people what our government is doing. This is very heavy-handed. You think of the live free or die state. This is not the way we project our American values to the world, and it's inhumane. We've been accused of human rights violations for separating these children from their families. And so we have a lot of questions and hope to get those answers tomorrow.
Again, that was Congresswoman Annie Custer on NHPR yesterday. So, Dean, what else have we been hearing from New Hampshire Democrats on this?
Democrats, as you'd expect, have been predictably outraged about the whole situation. That would have been my expectation. There's been just in general a lot of unhappiness with President Trump and his no tolerance policy on immigration. I think they recognize that it's going to be part of the larger discussion surrounding the midterm election. As you mentioned, I think appropriately, you know, even if some of the things that are happening here are a much smaller scale, it leads to an opportunity to talk about the broader issues like we're doing right now. So we have this checkpoint and five people were arrested, but it taps into the larger issue of what's going on in the country. And I think that keeps people interested and informed.
Yeah, when you talk about the politics of it, I often wonder about the timing of these things. I mean, our primary is so far away, it feels like. So do you think it depends on, you know, if this gets resolved, how long it takes?
Sure. Yeah, it's the second Tuesday in September, and I think it falls on 9/11 this year.
Yeah, it does.
Part of it certainly, you know, people check out over the summer and go on vacation and maybe not paying quite as close attention, and things always fire up right around Labor Day. So we'll see. A lot of it will depend what happens here. My sense of what's going on the southern border is it's sufficiently complex that it's going to take a while to sort all that out. And my guess is it'll sort of stay on our radar for a while. You know, whether it makes it all the way till November, we'll see. You know, part of the analysis has been from individuals has been that, you know, Trump sees this as a sort of a winning issue for him, or at a minimum, a way to mobilize his base to minimize losses in what, you know, typically the first midterm after a new president, presidents take a hit. I mean, the average seat loss for a president with over 50% popularity is about 36 seats. Below 50%, above 50%, it's 14 seats. Below 50%, and I think Trump is at 45 in the most recent Gallup, you lose roughly 36 seats. So this, I think he believes this is one way that he can kind of stem losses by, at a minimum, turning out sort of core supporters, because this is such an important issue to his core group of supporters.
Trent, you want to jump in?
And to Dean's point, you got to remember back in 2016 when he won the Republican primary in New Hampshire, it was that one of the top stronger borders was number one of the top three issues that Republican voters were voting on. And so this is, to Dean's point, this is an important part of his support along his base. And he won the New Hampshire primary largely because of it. So I can't imagine that kind of energy is going to be diverted before this year's primary and the general.
And we may, before the primary and midterm, may have a few more iterations of kind of big debates over whether or not Congress is going to fund the wall. You know, are they going to give him $25 billion or $35 billion, whatever he wants, versus just a couple billion? And so if that keeps popping up every few months, that's going to keep it in the news as well.
Well, I'm interested to see, we talked at the beginning about Republicans splitting on this. I mean, there were a lot of Republicans who came out against this no tolerance policy. And so I'm interested to see where Republicans go if they split, if they come back together, and, you know, in all the weeks leading up to the primary, where the party ends up here.
Yeah, what's really going to matter is can Republicans get enough Democrats in the Senate to stop a filibuster, and will the Conservative Freedom Caucus in the House of Representatives scuttle any kind of compromise legislation in the House? So this is by no means going to be an easy fix, and the whole DACA issue is still out there waiting to be resolved.
Never ending, that's for sure. So coming up, we'll have more news from New Hampshire. My colleague Casey McDermott will drop by to share her findings about lawmaker attendance at the State House. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. We also had my friend Robert Garova from NHPR. Thanks, Robert, for joining us here. We'd love for all of you to join in, too. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Or, of course, post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. I'm Lauren Chulgen, sitting in for Peter Biello. We'll be right back. You are listening to NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Lauren Chulgen, sitting in for Peter Biello, and I'm here in studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. And we would, of course, love for you to join us. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. The number to call, 1-800-892-6477. And a heads up for listeners that there are only a few conversations left, believe it or not, in our race for the first series. Host Laura Kanoy has been sitting down with candidates running in New Hampshire's first congressional district. And boy, what a lot of candidates there are in that one. On Monday, we're talking with Republican Eddie Edwards, and we would love to hear what questions you have for him. Send them now to theexchange@nhpr.org. You can listen back to all the interviews we've done thus far in the Race for the First series at nhpr.org, or you can subscribe to The Exchange podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. So, Trent and Dean, we didn't get to Trent's new favorite story, where he texted me literally the second the New York Times alert came down, so I'm going to you first. So the Supreme Court had a lot to say about our favorite topic, sales tax, did it not? What happened yesterday?
This is the biggest story in New Hampshire
this
year.
That's a lot to say from an editor. This is the biggest story in New Hampshire this year?
This is humongous. It makes this basically what's happened is that the Supreme Court ruled that New Hampshire retailers, and including retailers across the country, could be on the hook to collect sales tax from other states, other jurisdictions, basically after they upheld this case that South Dakota was fighting. So what does that mean? So that means that if you have a small business in New Hampshire or any kind of business in New Hampshire, and you, because we don't have a sales or income tax, if you don't normally collect sales tax, you will now have to collect and then send sales tax to 9,600 different taxing jurisdictions across the country.
9,600. How do you figure that?
Okay, because states can levy sales tax. Municipalities can levy.
Like counties or whatever.
Counties can. Water districts can. Fire districts can. Huh. And so if you are in one, if you run a New Hampshire business, and let's say somebody buys something online from you, and you send it to the, I don't know, I'm just making up the Joe Smith County Water District in Arizona, and there's a sales tax, a state sales tax, a local sales tax. You have to submit, you have to collect that sales tax, which is new for New Hampshire retailers because we don't do that right now. You then also have to send that money to all these different jurisdictions. And yes, there are 9,600 of them in the United States.
Dean, is this the biggest story? What do you think?
It's a pretty big story.
Dean slightly disagrees with you.
No, I don't disagree with him. I think it's going to take a while to sort out the kind of how it's going to play out. I mean, Governor Sununu said he was outraged, and the state's not going to go quietly with this decision. You know, potentially, as Trent said, it's an administrative nightmare for small businesses. You know, the backstory, it was a 5-4 decision, and the backstory here was that in 1992, there was a Quill Corporation versus North Dakota. banned states from requiring businesses to collect sales tax unless there was a physical presence or significant business in the state. So essentially what happened yesterday was the Supreme Court overturned that earlier decision. So states now and other jurisdictions now have an opportunity to collect sales tax. So, the argument was that the online marketplace has just fundamentally changed since the early 90s, which is true when you think about how we shop now. We'll see how this plays out. No, it's absolutely a huge story. How it's going to sort of be implemented and whether or not there are additional court challenges, I think, remains to be seen. But yeah, we've been waiting for a big story. We've been waiting for this one for a while. And this was interestingly enough, this decision was South Dakota versus Wayfair, the company you see on TV advertising all the
furniture and all that stuff.
Home goods, yeah.
So, and it's surprising to see, especially the 5-4 decision, because there was so much on both sides. There were a lot of people fighting for this. But really what happened was Congress didn't do anything, right? Like since 1992, the Supreme Court kind of kept their hands off and said, look, this is really Congress's job. The Congress should make a decision on how they want to treat this. And nothing ever happened in Congress. And so South Dakota came forward and said, with their law, you have to ship $100,000 of goods or have 200 annual transactions before you have to actually collect sales tax for South Dakota. But the Supreme Court decision went further than that. There's no minimum limit for how many. So you could potentially, let's say it's some small municipality that has a 2% sales tax on something. You could potentially have to send this municipality in the middle of who knows where.
Like 10 cents. 10
cents.
Right.
Right. And so it's an administrative nightmare for local New Hampshire businesses who have never done this before.
Is there anything that lawmakers here could do? I mean, but it sounds like maybe not.
Ooh, that's a great question, and I think that there's a lot of interest in there's something
Congress
can do.
Governor Sununu certainly sounded like this is not the last of this. I'm not sure what he's thinking, but yeah, certainly Congress could do something. Absolutely.
Well, speaking of Governor Sununu, I mean, is this ever the political question to be asked by me? But is this the one issue that Democrats and Republicans in New Hampshire can agree on?
There was Greg Moore, who runs Americans for Prosperity, called the second after I texted you, 2 seconds after the story came out, and he said this is probably the only thing that Americans for Prosperity, which is a very conservative group, and Jean mm-hmm. Shaheen agree on.
Because she came out immediately with the tweets against this, right, Dean? I mean, it was...
Yeah, this is for, you know, given the nature of the political discourse around taxes in the state, this is a no-brainer for any politician to oppose this.
Bipartisanship. It happened yesterday. We saw it. Trent was on it, texting at the breaking news. All right. Well, now, moving on from national news, joining us in studio is NHPR's Casey McDermott, my State of Democracy reporting buddy. Hi, Casey.
Hello.
How's it going?
Long time no see.
Long time no see. We sit next to each other, for those that don't know. You can see us sitting next to each other right here mm-hmm. on the video stream if you go to NHPR's Facebook page. Casey, tell us about the story you worked on this week. You had a kind of interesting data that you pulled about attendance records for New Hampshire lawmakers. And, you know, despite the fact that we have one of the largest representative bodies in the English-speaking world, you found not all 400 of those House members are actually showing up. What did you find?
Well, I found that actually I don't know that there's been a vote with 400 House members, you know, at any point in recent history, at least not for the years that are available to us to analyze. So basically, there's been a lot of chatter lately lamenting the fact that not a lot of lawmakers were showing up to votes. This became particularly pronounced when the school choice bill failed to pass. A lot of people laid the blame on absentee Republicans, given that, you know, if you look at the data for that particular vote, the margin of yeses and noes on that actually decided the outcome was actually larger than the number of Republicans missing. So some people speculated that, you know, listen, if more of the caucus showed up, perhaps the Republicans would have succeeded in advancing that particular part of their agenda. But I wanted to look at, you know, A, is it really that bad this year? And B, how does it fit into kind of the broader attendance pattern that we've seen in the House over the last few years? So what I did was I pulled actually publicly available data on the House website to look at, you know, what's the average attendance year by year, what's the average number of absentees. But I also wanted to look at how often did we see what we saw with the school choice bill, where the number of legislators who were missing was actually larger than the margin of difference on a particular bill deciding its fate. And I found that this year in particular, on about 60% of roll call votes. So that's where, you know, legislators request that everyone has to kind of, you know, register a position, yes or no. On about 60% of those votes, that was the case. So more legislators were missing than those who were actually deciding the outcome. So that was kind of an indication that things were, you know, bad this year. But when you look at the average number of legislators present through the years, dating back to about 2011, we've averaged only around like 350 or so. It fluctuates year by year. This year, the average was about 330 legislators participating on any given roll call vote. So that's well below
the 400.
Yeah. And we're also seeing that, you know, unexcused absences and excused absences are pretty on par throughout the years. This year, there were an average of 39 legislators who registered excused to be out for a given vote. And really all that means is they let the House clerk know that they were going to be out, and an average of 23 were unexcused on any given roll call vote. So that just means that they didn't give anyone a heads up.
Huh. So I feel funny even asking this question, because you think if, you know, you run for office and you do all the campaigning, but I mean, where are they? Why aren't they showing up?
A variety of reasons. I mean, some people have legitimate, you know, illnesses, family illnesses, death in the family. A lot of people work. And given the fact that the House meets during the day and does a lot of its business during the workday, it can be challenging for people to show up. That said, House leadership will say, look, you knew what you were signing up for. We ask 1 or 2 days a week during session to actually vote. And it's also important to note that absences aren't just affecting the, you know, the votes that are taking place on the House floor. They're also affecting the actual kind of policymaking that happens in committees. Some people have asked actually to not even be on a committee because, you know, either they don't think they can show up or they just don't want to. And House Speaker Gene Chandler said that that's also a big problem in his eyes, is just getting people to show up to do the kind of nuts and bolts policymaking that you need to get laws passed.
Yeah, throwing this open to you guys, I mean, how could this impact the functions of the House or lawmaking?
It's a fascinating statistic to me. I mean, this is the flip side of the issue of whether you have a volunteer legislature or a professional legislature. You know, the argument against a professionalized legislature in which people earn salaries is that you get a kind of a class of career politicians who are open to all kinds of sort of perverse incentives for behavior that don't necessarily represent people's interests over time. So that's one of the arguments against having a professional legislature, but with the citizen volunteer legislature, which essentially you get $100 plus mileage, and there was some talk of withholding that $100, which I don't know how much of an incentive that is. But the issue is people work. As it is, I think we have one of the oldest average ages. It's like 62 is the average age. The oldest, yeah. So it was fascinating to me that in theory, major legislative decisions are being skewed by this exogenous issue of simply whether or not people are showing up. It's just fascinating to me. I really enjoyed reading that.
It was interesting, too. I got some feedback from legislators on the piece, and a few people, particularly those on the younger side of the legislature, wrote back. Representative Brandon Finney wrote to me and said, as a 30-year-old father and husband who works full-time, I can tell you that making every single vote is impossible for those of us who are not already independently wealthy or retired. He also said this contributes to the average age of the New Hampshire House of Representatives. You know, first-term Rep. Brian Stone of Northwood actually introduced a bill to study legislator compensation, both in terms of, you know, mileage and whether there are ways that they could incentivize more people to be there by the kind of the way that they incentivize mileage or things like that. And he said that, you know, one of the benefits of keeping the same system in place is that you get a few experienced career and party guys that have a lot more control as less people show up than the ones that do get regularly cycled out. And those are both Republicans. So this is not necessarily a, you know, just a thing that Democrats are talking about as well. I also heard from some people who brought up that issue of when the House meets and saying, you know, do we look at whether or not it's time to move a lot of the work to the evening, like a, you know, town or city government? That's when a lot of those take place, and you get maybe more involvement, not only from legislators, but also from members of the public who might not be able to make things things during the day.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, I remember when I was at St. A's, there was a guy a couple years or maybe a year under me that was a state rep. And I remember being like, how? I can't even have time to do finals. Like, I mean, how do you have time to go
yeah.
to? And so it
can be a challenge, actually, particularly for younger people. I looked, and I should put a plug in. We both have statistics about the House at large, but we also made a tool that if you want to find out how often your state representative is showing up, you can go to nhpr.org, and we built a tool that allows you to search for your rep or the reps in your district and see, you know, how many votes they missed, either for excused or unexcused purposes. But just talking about that issue of students, I've talked to some people who said, look, you know, I was able to kind of, I got lucky. I could work my class schedule around when we were meeting. But other people, you know, several of the representatives who had some of the highest absentee rates this year were, you know, I think college aged. And I have to imagine that their class schedules or demands of just being, you know, kind of a college student made it difficult for them to fully represent their constituents.
Huh. How bad was this year? You mentioned the 330-ish compared to other years.
It's actually not that much of an outlier. If you look at, you know, both averages and also the maximum number of, so like the highest participation rate by year, this year the highest roll call attendance was 354. And that was the lowest in the last 8 years or so, but it's not that much lower. Like last year was 378. Year before that was 366. Year before that was 365. So we're, you know, at least a dozen or so, if not more, below 400 in any given year.
Huh. It's also the beautiful part of the New Hampshire legislature. And I think that this is...
joys and pitfalls.
This is the joy of it, which is that it's overlooked. So in many other places, right, where there's a Republican governor, Republican majorities in the House and the Senate, right, all of these things, right to work, education savings accounts, all these things should have passed, right? And
right.
I remember being on the show, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's going to pass. All the Republicans are just going to sweep everything out. And that didn't happen. And that's the beautiful part of this citizen legislature, is that because you can't always get everybody to turn out, you can get really important issues passed. But if you can't get people there, if you can't get people fired up, if you can't even get the state reps fired up, maybe that policy or procedure or whatever you are trying to change, maybe it needs more work.
Well, then, speaking of the state legislature, you can get people to show up, but then the governor says, no, no, I don't think so. The death penalty this week, Dean. I mean, we all saw this coming, right?
Yeah, he was very clear that he was going to veto any attempt at repealing the death penalty. We saw Gene Shaheen do the same thing back in, I believe, 1999 or 2000. Mm-hmm. He had support of law enforcement on this. We currently have Michael Addison, one individual on death row. And we've talked before about the issues surrounding cost and the fact that we haven't executed anyone in the state, I think, for
1939.
Yeah, 70, yeah. Something like, you know, almost 80 years now. So we've talked before about how the coalition surrounding death penalty repeal has really changed as we've seen issues of DNA testing and differential application of the death penalty around the country. A number of other states have either suspended it or repealed it. So it's, to me, the politics feel different than they did 10 or 20 years ago. But nonetheless, Governor Sununu was very clear that he was going to veto this, and he went through on that. I'm not sure. Maybe one of the other folks know. If this is a veto-proof majority, they need 2/3 in the House and State House and Senate to override it. I don't know that they have that. I'm not sure.
That was going to be my next question.
Senate,
yeah,
is going to be the challenge.
Right. I think they're going to be about two votes short in the Senate. Mm-hmm.
So we got an email from Dennis from Barrington on this, and he says, sadly, by vetoing the legislative repeal of the death penalty, Governor Sununu has shown that he places his political interests above enacting the will of the people as expressed through their representatives. The death penalty serves the political purpose of immunizing supporters against attacks of being soft on crime. That the governor views this issue through a political lens was demonstrated by his highly orchestrated photo op at yesterday's veto signing. So I think
he was surrounded, I believe, by police officers. He gave the pen to the widow of Officer Briggs,
yeah,
who was killed. It was sending a very clear signal.
So you're saying, Casey, that the Senate might be the difficult place to see the override?
I think so.
So here's the deal. They need 16 votes in the Senate. This passed out of the Senate with 14 votes. The House would need 254 votes to override the veto, if you count all the 385 reps who are currently technically in office, and it passed out of the House with 223. So the Senate, definitely they'll be short. The House, who knows, depending on who shows up, but they would need a couple of votes there too.
So here's a question. I mean, obviously, there are tons of bills that the governor signs, but why? What do you think factors into his decision about which ones to have bill signing for and which ones to not?
This one was incredibly emotional, right? Yeah. There were police officers there, the wife of a fallen police officer, a Manchester police officer. This was an important topic for him, not just politically, but I think personally, too. I think this is where he really – this is what he truly believes as a person. And so, you know, yes, are there optics involved in these bill signings? Of course. But I think this one was just – purely emotional and where he stood on the issue.
What do you think, Dean? How do they make that call?
Yeah, I think Trent's right. I think it's a combination. I mean, it varies from chief executive to chief executive, but I always think there's an element of kind of ideology and genuine belief combined with the kind of the particular political constellation in the state. But I don't sense that this was some sort of instrumental calculation by him for electoral reason. He seems to genuinely believe that this was the right thing to do. The death penalty is one of those issues that's always very emotional. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of the issues that people are sometimes instrumental on when they figure out their positions, I think more often than not, people really come from a place of conviction on this when they vote. Not always the case, but compared to some other issues, I think it's one of those sort of core belief issues that you either feel one way or the other, and perhaps your feelings have changed based on, as we've seen with Republicans and some conservatives, perhaps your feelings have changed based on some of the empirical evidence about misapplication and DNA problems and things like that.
Go ahead, Trent.
I covered a capital murder trial. It was the John Brooks trial. He was convicted of murdering a handyman who he thought wronged him in some way, that there was no evidence of that. And I had, on a personal level, you know, as a reporter going into this, you come in objectively, but I just fundamentally did not understand the death penalty. Why does this exist? How does it? Why? But spending 2 months covering this trial, literally being in that trial, sitting with the family every day for every single day, you understand the emotional side of this. And what the family, the family of Jack Reed said was, this is the only way we feel like we can get justice. There is no other way that we think we can get justice for this man killing our father and our husband. And it really opened my eyes to the these families who go through something so terrible and what they are seeking through the court system.
Well, coming up, we'll have NHPR's Andy Ropeek join us to break down the latest in energy news. Lots of news happening this week. Fascinating story from the union leader about so-called chief days at the Manchester Police Department. Can't wait to talk to Trent about that one. You are listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're speaking with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the Schools of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. We also had NHPR's Casey McDermott pop by for a few. Thank you, Casey.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Don't worry. And you can catch us online, live video. Very exciting. Video of radio. It never escapes me to be hilarious. Check it out at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Post on our Facebook page or shoot us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Lauren Chulgen, sitting in the host chair for Peter Biello. I'm here with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. You should give us a call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. We've also had a few of my NHPR colleagues popping in and out this hour, so that's been lots of fun. But before we get to some more local news, I want to have a moment for the Union Leader, man, Trent. This story is wild, okay? We had a story in the Union Leader about chief days. Can you even just, let's just start with what's a chief day?
A chief day, and there were 108 of them in the last fiscal year. Chief day is something that the Manchester police chief has been giving out to officers in exchange for example, not taking a sick day. 47 officers got a chief day,
okay,
for not calling out sick. 41 officers got a chief day for volunteering to work at the foot race for the fallen, which is a 5K in the city. Other people got chief days for being officer of the month. There were about 16 of those. You could get a chief day for doing outstanding work during one of your shifts. And so what can you use this chief day for? If you want to take a day off and you have a chief day in the bank, rather than having to use a vacation day, you can use a chief day. Here's the problem. is that the city's HR director says these are off-the-book payments. These appear to be off-the-book payments, which means that the city, potentially on the back end, when these police officers go to retire, because they had used chief days along the way instead of vacation time, mm-hmm. which is on the books and being recorded through City Hall, they could use these unrecorded and unrecorded chief days and then cash out that vacation time at the end.
Oh.
And so you can cash out up to 400 hours of vacation time and something like 900 hours of sick time. And there were 108 of these. Now, the Manchester police say these are really important because you can't – if you take a chief day, someone can't come in on overtime. So it actually saves us money, though I'm unclear on how that calculation works. And the other thing is that it kind of incentivizes people not to, you know, to work hard, to volunteer for this foot race for the fallen, to not call in sick, all kinds of other things. So they actually say we'd prefer to have a chief day than other kinds of variations. But as soon as we posted the story, within about 90 minutes of us breaking the story, chief days were suspended. The chief said, there are some questions apparently about this practice, and we are going to suspend it immediately. There are also some questions about whether these were ever approved, whether aldermen ever knew about it. We checked with Mayor Joyce Craig. She had no idea. We checked with Mayor Ted Gatzis. He had no idea. We actually checked with every living Manchester police chief and every living Manchester mayor, and none of them had any recollection, and there's no record of when these things started or who approved them or how they – there's no documentation. So it's a little bit of an interesting situation happening.
Well, and
right now.
How did you guys find out about them?
So we found out about it. It was one sentence in this kind of three-page we also broke this story on Sunday about allegations of rape from a woman in Manchester who said two former Manchester police officers raped her and all kinds of other things. And as part of that letter, it said that one of the officers was on a chief day. And none of us had ever heard of this before. And so we started calling, what's chief day? No one who covered the police, and we have people who have worked at the union leader for 30 years and have covered police for three decades and had never heard of a chief day. And so we started calling around to aldermen and to the mayors. And Ted Gatzis, who was mayor for 8 years, he was alderman before that, he said, I have never heard of this before, never once. So we decided to just ask a whole bunch of questions about it. And within 90 minutes of the story posting, the policy was suspended.
So before we leave this, I want to know, you said the mayor said she didn't know about it, but where, you know, how has she responded to all of this, and where's the story going to go from here?
At first, Mayor Craig did not respond. Her first response was, look, it's up to the police chief. She did not make herself available for interviews, did not want to talk about it. And then as time went by, and I think as pressure built, decided, and I don't even know if she decided or if the city's HR person and attorney decided that they needed to launch an investigation into this. So right now what's happening is the city has launched an investigation. They're doing an audit of these practices. And I just want to just be clear that Chief Willard definitely did not, while he's the chief now, he was not the one who started this. It's unclear when it started. Chief Willard said he got a chief day. He actually just texted me saying that he just found a record of himself getting a chief day from Chief Craig, who is the current mayor's father-in-law, in February of 1991. So this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
But it's just unclear when it started, what the rules are, who approved it, and what it's costing the taxpayer.
Man, journalism, am I right?
Am I right?
Am I right? I mean, I'll be reading the Union Leader, that's for sure. And when I'm not reading the Union Leader, I'm sitting next to Annie Ropeek, my colleague at NHPR. Hi, Annie.
Hi, Lauren.
And so you're here because, along with all of the news that we've talked about this week, there was a couple energy and environment little breaking bits, right? So let's start with a couple of the vetoes that happened. We talked about the death penalty repeal veto earlier, but there were two energy-related bills that he vetoed. I know you were watching. First one about net metering. What is net metering? Remind us about that, and what would this bill have done?
So net metering is commonly used for people that have solar on the rooftop of their house, for example, and it lets electric ratepayer create their own electricity and put it back into the grid and get some money off their bill for that. It's effectively a subsidy for a person generating their own renewable power. And it can be used for home solar, but it also could be used for larger scale solar on a factory or Nashua. The city of Nashua has some hydropower dams that they are net metering and that kind of thing. So the bill the governor vetoed this week would have expanded the cap on net metering for those big customers, people like Nashua, the city of Nashua, and factories, would have let them net meter more power, basically. So generate more of their own power and get more money off their bills for doing that.
Okay. And we actually have a caller about net metering. How exciting. Penn T is on the line. Hi there.
Hi. I thought I would call on this. I guess the issue is calling this a subsidy. I usually think of it as access to the retail market. There's plenty of subsidy for renewables, but net metering isn't one of them. Basically, what this does, first of all, this was a bipartisan agreement, but at the legislature, and it by not allowing this, it restricts communities, industries and others from trying to reduce their cost of energy, just as it does for residential customers.
Huh. Thanks so much, Penn T, for the call. We appreciate it. So, Annie, go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is sort of what the debate comes down to, is whether or not this is, in fact, a subsidy, or sort of how true of a subsidy is it. So
okay.
Critics of net metering say that this is a handout, and supporters of it say that it encourages renewable generation and it allows people to save on their bills, which is, in theory, part of the all-of-the-above strategy that the state is pursuing. So there is going to be an override effort on this one. It seems pretty clear. As the caller said, there was a bipartisan support for this in the State House, and the governor says it would cost ratepayers too much money kind of in the short term, but advocates I've been talking to say that sort of ignores the long-term savings that it could bring.
Does the governor consider it a subsidy? Does he talk about it as though it's a subsidy?
I don't know that he's used the word subsidy, but I do think they consider it to be. So they say that renewables should compete on their own merits. So I think if reading between the lines of that, they think of it as sort of a handout to renewables that they shouldn't need in order to be part of the mix.
Huh. So something that was interesting to me was we got a statement almost like immediately from Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley. I mean, Dean and Trent jump in on this. Is that rare to see the Senate Majority Leaders oppose the governor in that way?
I mean, this is an issue I think it's important to him. He's talked about it in the past. You know, there's been this debate about the extent to which Governor Sununu is committed to renewables or is kind of shifting. You know, he made a statement a while back about shifting away from, you know, an explicit focus on renewables to focusing more on just the cost of energy, whatever that might be. And some people see that as kind of a backdoor to bringing in more traditional fossil fuels, natural gas, things like that. So it's in the context of this larger debate. Bradley has been a part of that for a long time.
Then there was another bill, right, Annie, about biomass that he vetoed as well. What was that about?
So that is another part of the reason that Senator Bradley has jumped on this. That was one of his signature bills. But, you know, all of the biomass issues are big for him. And the bill that Governor Sununu vetoed would have basically told energy companies to buy more biomass. So it wasn't a cash subsidy or a cash incentive, but it was a way to prop up the biomass industry by sort of mandating that they be a bigger part of the fuel mix. So the governor is vetoing that bill, but it seems as though he is not going to veto another bill, which is basically another sort of cash bailout package for Burgess Biomass Plant and some of the North Country biomass industry that Senator Bradley is really interested in protecting.
Huh. All right. So there were those two bills and then PFAS. Is that how I say
it? Here I am again.
Here you are again with the PFAS. All right. So this week, the CDC had a study about it, and the EPA reportedly had asked them, you know, wait on this. So what did the study actually say, and what does it mean for contamination in New Hampshire?
Yeah, so this is a study from the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, which is part of the CDC, that the EPA had reportedly worried would be a public relations nightmare if it was released. And this is a study that basically says these industrial chemicals, man-made substances called PFAS, which is a whole class of chemicals used in things like Teflon and mm-hmm. Gore-Tex, and nonstick products for years. Not so much anymore. They are declining in the country. That's one thing the CDC points out, that the amount of them in the bloodstream of the population is getting lower because they have not been widely manufactured or imported in the U.S. since about 2000. But the CDC report says these substances are dangerous to humans at a lot lower levels than the EPA and states like New Hampshire currently regulate. So this is what the EPA, it seems like, was worried would come out. It's what a lot of residents have been saying for a long time who live in contaminated areas. And the CDC isn't recommending regulations. That's not what they do. But they're recommending sort of the risk level that public health professionals should look at when they evaluate these substances in communities to say if they're present in a place at this level, we might want to take another look at that place. And this comes as the EPA is working on crafting new standards for PFAS. And so kind of the next question is, how much are they going to factor this data in?
Okay. And you spoke with a Merrimack resident, Lorraine Allen, who was affected by the Saint-Gobain contamination. And she says she was alarmed by the CDC's findings about how long these chemicals can take to break down.
That's going to be in this town, you know, when my kids die. You know, it's really mind-boggling.
So just wrapping up this conversation here, I mean, what the state, you know, what are they saying? And are people like Lorraine kind of freaked out about this?
Yeah, so the state isn't saying much. Lorraine was disappointed that the state didn't sort of take a stronger reaction to this. They said, you know, we're glad the study came out. We're going to read it. And I mean, it's 850 pages. You all saw me spending about 5 hours reading that the other day. And they have just said, you know, we'll see what we need to do in response to it. They haven't said, we're going to look at lowering our levels. They haven't even said, you know, this suggests that our levels may be too high. The state uses the same level as the federal government suggests to limit PFAS in our drinking water. And so, you know, people like Lorraine acknowledge that that's not going to change overnight. They would like the state to be giving them more bottled water, encouraging more testing, that kind of thing. So we may see some of that coming, you know, as we the state keeps working on sites like Saint-Gobain, which is where Lorraine lives, mm-hmm. or the Coakley landfill on the seacoast. And then this all comes ahead of the big federal meeting about PFAS that's going to be in Exeter on Monday and Tuesday. So it's sure to come up there as well.
Well, we know you'll be following that. And so, Dean and Trent, any stories you'll be following this week, next week?
We have a serious story coming up in the Sunday News. In the past month, two Granite State children have killed themselves after being bullied at school, including an 11-year-old just this week. Data shows that instances of bullying have been cut in half since 2010, but state officials and advocates think that those numbers are not correct. So we're taking a look at the issue. What's going right? What's going wrong?
Man, what about you, Dean?
Yeah, as I mentioned last week, you know, we're only a week and a half away from July 4th. That's the traditional summer kickoff to the political campaign season. Expect to see a lot of people running for office, marching in parades and out campaigning over the summer while people are, you know, hopefully doing some other things and vacationing as well. But it's always a busy time up here in an election year.
You mean it's not already busy on the campaign?
It is busy. It'll turn it up a notch over the summer.
I love summer and I love politics. So I like Dean. I think he really ended us on a good note. Thank you, Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, Trent Spinner of the Union Leader, for coming in today. And thanks to my buddies at NHPR, Annie Ropeek, Casey McDermott, and Robert Garova. You can find links to all the stories discussed today at nhpr.org. And remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Lauren Chulgen. No worries, Peter will be back next week. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.